And thanks again, Miles and Roger, for the kind invitation to speak here. It's really a great pleasure, and I would really wish that this conference is like the first conference of a whole series of conferences of this type, combining quantum and machine learning. So here's the outline of the talk. I will start with a very brief introduction into topic modeling. Then I will explain a physics perspective on topic modeling. Then this talk is about association rule mining, so we'll have to tell you what association rule mining is. And then I will then we come to the central part of this talk, which is about the question how we can use matrix factorization techniques for association rule mining. Then I will present some numerical results, and then in the final talk, final part of the talk, I will conclude this talk. All right, so here is a very brief introduction into topic modeling. And to explain to you what topic modeling is about, I'd like you to imagine that you're the chief editor of the New York Times, and you just finished digitalizing all articles that appeared since the founding year of the New York Times, which I think is 1851. Now, the result of this endeavor is that you end up with a huge corpus of text documents, D1, D2, D3, and so on. And I think you will intuitively agree with me that a text document has a topic assigned to it. So for instance, a newspaper article can be about politics, it can be about sports, finance, and so on. For example, we could have a newspaper article the newspaper article number 217, which is about a baseball game, and it just happened to be the case that at this baseball game, President Obama threw the first pitch. So this article is primarily about sports, but it also happens to be a bit about politics because President Obama is a political figure, and therefore it is also a bit about politics. So intuitively, we could say that this article is maybe 80% about sports and 20% about politics. All right, so this I hope you agree that this kind of intuitively makes sense, but now how can we infer these topic distributions that we assign to text documents? And this is actually precisely the objective of topic modeling. Topic modeling takes as input text documents and outputs topic distributions describing the text document. Now, it turns out that there are basically two major classes of topic models. The first one is probabilistic latent semantic indexing, PLSI, and the second one is latent Dirichlet allocation, LDA. I just put in some citation counts so that you believe me that this is an important field. And so there are these two major classes of topic models, and it actually turns out that they are basically equivalent. So LDA is a Bayesian method, and it turns out that PLSI is a maximum a posteriori estimate of LDA. So what is PLSI? Let's focus on PLSI. In probabilistic latent semantic indexing, we regard each word in the text document as an IID random variable drawn from a fixed vocabulary. And to be more precise here, if we focus on a document DJ in our corpus of documents, we set the probability of the ith word in the text to be equal to W from the vocabulary, equal to the inner product of two multinomial distributions. The first multinomial distribution is a distribution that we assign to the jth document DJ, and the second multinomial distribution is a multinomial distribution that we assign to T, where T is a placeholder for, T labels a abstract topic. So T is equal to 1 could represent something like politics, T is equal to 2 could represent something like finance, and so on. So this is the basic assumption underlying PLSI. All right, so now I'd like to regard these types of models from the perspective of statistical physics. And to do this, we need to slightly reformulate this expression for the probabilities. And I'd like to do this by introducing vectors FW for each word W of the vocabulary, and I'd like to introduce vectors PD assigned to each text document from the text corpus.
And more precisely,
we define the t-th
component of the vector fw as the probability forward w given the topic t. And I'd like to set the t-th component of the vector pd equal to the probability for topic t given the document d. And from this definition, you immediately see now, due to normalization of probability distributions, that if you sum the vectors fw over the whole vocabulary, you end up with the vectors of all ones. And therefore, we have that all representations of words in the vocabulary form, if we collect them in the form of this matrix, then this matrix is contained in the set M, where M is defined in this manner. So this set M characterizes the representations of words. So we have words represented as this matrix in M, and we have documents represented as probability distributions. And I denote probability distributions in terms of delta here. All right, now we'd like to interpret this from the perspective of classical statistical mechanics, where traditionally we work with a phase space, and to be a bit more specific, let's assume that we consider a single point particle in R3, and then the phase space is equal to R3 times R3. States in this setting are described as probability distributions mu, or probability meshes mu, on the phase space gamma. Observables or measurements are described as functions from gamma to R. And then we set the probability for f, the measurement f, to attain a value in the interval from A to B equal to the measure of the pre-image of the interval from A to B under f. All right, so this is the traditional kinematics in statistical mechanics. Now, let's go to a finite formulation of this, where we set the phase space equal to a finite set. Gamma is equal to omega 1 up to omega capital T. We set states equal to probability vectors, which are probability measures on this finite set gamma. And we model observables or measurements as functions from gamma to some finite set 1 to capital W. And then, as before, we have that the probability of the observable f, or the measurement f, to attain value w is equal to the probability of the pre-image of w under f, which can be written as the inner product between the probability vector and a binary vector ew, where the components of the binary vector ew mark the pre-image of omega under f. So it's an indicator vector that marks the pre-image of W under F. So if you have this representation of measurements in terms of vectors EW and of states in terms of vectors P, then we have that the binary matrix whose columns are the measurement outcomes are contained in a set M0, where M0 is defined in this manner. And again, due to normalization, we have that these vectors sum to the vector of all ones. And therefore, comparing this expression with the expression from before, from topic modeling, we see that the set of measurement, the set of the representations of words in topic modeling corresponds to the convex hull or the convex relaxation of the set of measurements in statistical mechanics. And in this sense, you can regard topic modeling as a partial convex relaxation of a statistical mechanics. And this now motivates a metaphor where we say that in PLSI or in topic modeling in general, where we call the distributions PD assigned to the topics, to the document, sorry, we call these state representations of a document, and we can call these matrices here representations of the measurement, what is the mth word for an arbitrary m in the document. So we can talk about states and measurements in the setting of topic modeling. And this metaphor is actually appreciated in the social sciences. So here this is a picture I took at ICML. This was a talk entitled interpretability and measurement, why social scientists like topic models. This is a talk given by Hannah Wallach from Microsoft Research. So this is something, this metaphors really help social scientists interpret data. All right, so now, but the main part of this talk is that this was a part of about topic modeling, but the main part of the talk is about, the core of the talk is about association rule mining. So before we come back to topic modeling, I'd like to explain what association rule mining is. All right, and to explain association rule mining, I'd like you to forget about your previous role of being a chief editor of the New York Times, and now I'd like you to imagine that you run a grocery store or a supermarket. And so you have customers, they come into your store and they buy products and then they go to the checkout and they pay for their what they selected. And now you imagine that if you collect some data about the behavior of the customers, you may be able to increase revenue. So you start collecting data in the following form. So you have, for each transaction that happens at the checkout, you write down what has been bought. So for the first customer, you may have that the first customer bought bread, milk, cheese, no beer, no diapers, no salami. Then the second customer may have bought bread, no milk, some cheese, some beer, some diapers, no salami, and so on. So you start ending up with data of this form. Now you have this data, now you start staring at it, and after a while you may notice some patterns. For instance, you may realize that people who bought cheese also bought bread, but not the other way around. Or you may realize that people who bought salami bought bread, but not the other way around necessarily. And finding these types of rules in the data is the objective of association rule mining, and these rules are called association rules. And I think you may agree with me that finding these rules are very important in practice. Here, I just discussed this simple example for market basket analysis because it's very illustrative. But of course, this has important consequences in healthcare, where we may be interested to understand how different treatments affect different symptoms or survival of patients. Okay, now many of us are physicists, so maybe we would be very happy if we could find a statistical mechanics model for this type of data, because this is what we know, this is what we like. So let's assume that we were actually able to do this for the moment. Let's assume we were able to find such a finite statistical mechanics formulation for these types of data sets. And by this I mean that, for instance, we could hope for a representation of this data set where we set the probability for a market basket to contain bread given a customer U or transaction U to be equal to the inner product between a probability vector PU and a binary vector E bread. So let's assume that we were able to find good vectors PU and E bread, where bread is just a representative of one of the columns of the data matrix, such that the data is likely or is predictive. Let's just assume this for the moment. And let's also assume that it were true that the support of the binary vector E cheese was contained in the support of the binary vector E bread, where by support I mean the location of the ones in these binary vectors. Then it has to be true that customers who are likely to buy cheese are likely to buy bread as well. That's simply because this inner product just integrates the probability on the support of the vector E bread. So if customers are likely to buy cheese, then it means that their probability distribution is largely supported on cheese and therefore also on bread. And given this observation here, we may now define in an association rule, cheese implies bread from such an observation here. Here we just ask, not different from before, we don't ask whether the mth product is bread, but we ask whether the basket contains bread. So they can be overlapping. That's a very good question. So we speak about this assumes binary measurements, if you want. Is there bread or is there no bread? Is there cheese or is there no cheese in the basket? Very good question. All right, so this is our ansatz for the definition of association rules starting from these types of models. Now the problem is, and this makes a lot of sense if these models are actually predictive in this setting. The problem is that these models are hard to infer. These vectors are highly constrained and they are hard to infer from the data. On the other hand, we have another class of models which is easy to infer and which are very, very widely applied in practice, and these are so-called matrix factorization models. And this motivates then the objective of this work, where we try to use introduce a definition of association rules starting from matrix factorizations and getting inspiration from here. Now, to approach this result that we find, I'd like to now reformulate this definition of association rules in terms of properties of e-cheese, e-bread, and so on, as a variational principle. So previously we had that we define cheese implies bread if and only if the support of cheese is contained in the support of bread. Now, it's really not too hard to see that this happens to be the case if and only if a variable that we introduce, e cheese bread, is equal to 1, where e cheese bread is defined as the minimum of p transpose e bread, such that p is an arbitrary probability distribution, and such that p transpose e cheese is equal to 1. Or put differently, taking a physics perspective, this is equal to the minimum of p transpose e bread, such that p is an element of the set of every possible p, such that p transpose e cheese is equal to 1. And in physics, we would call this set here, the set of every possible state, we could call it state space. Or in quantum foundations, we would call it state space. And therefore, we have now a definition of association rules in terms of an optimization procedure on state space. And we can straightforwardly generalize this to topic modeling if you want. All right, so now we have this variational definition of association rules, and now we can apply this to matrix factorization models. So what are matrix factorization models? Let me explain that first. So to explain what matrix factorization models are, we imagine again that we have a data matrix as before, for instance, this transaction data, and let's call this data matrix R. So it could be the market basket data matrix from before. Now, a very common assumption is that this matrix is low rank, and this happens to be the case in many applications. So let's assume this. Let's assume that this matrix is low rank, and let's set D equal to the rank of this matrix, this data matrix R. And then by linear algebra, we know that there exists vectors AU and BI, d-dimensional vectors, with the property that RUI is equal to the inner product between AU and BI for each row U of R and each column I of R. And taking the previous picture where we had the inner product between PU and E bread as a metaphor, we think of these vectors now as states and measurements. So AU, we regard AU as a state, and we regard BI as a measurement. And now we take the variational principle from before, and this inspires us to write down this definition of eta ij, where I and j are columns of R. So we define eta ij as the minimum of S transpose bj, such that S is an element of the set of every possible vector AU, with the property that S transpose bi is equal to 1. And again, as before, what is the set of every possible vector, the set of all possible vectors AU? This is the set of all possible states, and we call this a state space. Whereas, different from before, this state space is less structured, and this is a state space that, that would appear in quantum foundations. And now, given this definition of eta ij, we again define an association, the association rule I implies j if eta ij is equal to 1. And this, this definition exactly captures what we want, right? So because this means that every possible state that gives one for I also gives one for j. So having something for I implies having something for j. That's what we want. But we so now we have this definition, but we have a problem here because this optimization problem is not well defined as it is now because we don't know really what this state space S is. We have no mathematical characterization of this state space. So what is this state space? Can we characterize it? So let's first write it down in what it is in principle. So the state space is the set of is containing the set of linear functionals on the set of measurement representations. So it is equal to vectors A with the property that A transpose V is contained in the interval from 0 to 1 for all V in the set of measurement representations. So this is the set that we'd like to characterize. But we don't know how to do that. So let's, but what we know how to do is to, we know how to find inner and outer approximations of this state space. We have an inner approximation because we can just take the vectors AU that appear in our matrix vectorization and take their convex hull. And this serves as an inner approximation of the state space because these vectors necessarily lie in state space. So this is the inner approximation. On the other hand, we get an outer approximation by relaxing these inner product, these linear constraints appearing in the definition of S. So instead of forcing the vectors A to have inner product in 0 and 1 for all measurement representations, we now only pick the measurement representations that appear in our particular matrix vectorization. These are the vectors BI. So we introduce the set of vectors A with property A transpose BI is in 0 to 1 for all columns in the data matrix. And this serves as a definition of the outer approximation of state space. And now we go back to the definition of eta ij from before. And now instead of optimizing over S, we just optimize over the inner and outer approximations. And this gives us upper and lower bounds for the value we actually care about, namely eta ij. And different from before, we actually now can compute this in, these upper and lower approximations. And we can use now this inner and upper approximation to define approximate association rules. And in the remainder, I will focus on the outer approximation because it turns out that in real world data, the empirical states are very deep in state space, and it's hard to find any approximation rules at all. So we go to the outer approximation with the risk that we find approximation rules which are virtual or artificial. So we define I implies J if and only if the outer approximation of eta ij is equal to 1. And this has a neat side effect that the complexity, the time complexity to infer such an association rule is independent of the number of transactions U. So this makes sense if this is useful if the number of transactions is huge. All right, so now let's look at some numerical results. I hope are there any questions about this before we go to numerical results? Okay, so let's look at some results. We start with some synthetic data, where we sample synthetic data from a statistical mechanics model with highly mixed states and with measurements that are structured in this manner. This is, of course, too small to read for you. But this diagram says that we have a measurement E15 whose support is contained in the measurement, I also have a hard time to read this, E7. And the support of the measurement E7 is contained in the support of the measurement 3, and so on. So these connections indicate how supports of measurements are included in each other. And this is this types of figure. This figure is what we aim at inferring from the data. And our baseline algorithm that we compare the results with is the underlying principle of the so-called a priori algorithm, which was designed for the inference of association rules. And this is the major algorithm in this area. All All right, so this is what the baseline does. So this is the type, this is the result that is found by the a priori algorithm. All these rules that are found, they're correct. They agree. I promise you that these are correct results. But the algorithm misses a lot of rules. Now, this is the result for the matrix factorization-based approach. If we pick the right dimension, which generically is equal to the rank of the data matrix, then we reconstruct the diagram perfectly. So this is the top layer in this figure. Now, if we pick the dimension too low, then we start making some errors. So this is the 16-dimensional case. We correctly infer the structure. This is the 14-dimensional case. So we make some errors, but overall it looks pretty good. But even for the D dimension, even if you assume the dimension of the data is 12 instead of 16, we still do pretty well. I mean, we make some errors. We have some artificial connections due to outer approximation, but we still do pretty well. The structure is overall is the low-lying structure can be inferred. Now let's look at some real-world data in the movie recommendation setting, where we imagine that we are on Netflix, and we offer users to watch movies on our platform. So for instance, we could have users Alice, Bob, Charlie, and Donald, and we offer movies to watch Jurassic Park, Casablanca, Airplane, and Notting Hill. Now as feedback from the users, we get 5-star ratings for movies. So for instance, we may have that the user Alice really dislikes Jurassic Park, returns a 1-star rating, really likes the movie Casablanca, likes Airplane, and kind of likes Notting Hill, and so on. So we get these 5-star ratings from the users, and this is the type of data that we have as Netflix. Now, to test the proposed method for association rule mining, we use a data set called the MovieLens data set, which contains 1 million 5-star ratings, and 6,000 users contributed to this data set, and the data set specifies ratings for 3,700 movies. All right, so now let's look at some association rules. Let's look at the movie Jurassic Park. What is implied by Jurassic Park? So here in the left column, we have movies recommended by a priori, the baseline. The baseline, and on the right-hand side, we have the movies recommended by the matrix factorization-based approach. So the baseline recommends 2 Star Wars movie, the Matrix movie, Terminator 2, Men in Black. The matrix factorization approach proposes Stargate. I actually don't know this movie. Independence Day, the other Jurassic Park, Men in Black as well, and Total Recall. I don't know what this movie is. Here's another example, Casablanca. The baseline recommends, again, a Star Wars movie. This actually makes sense if you think about the workings of the baseline. It makes sense. So it recommends Star Wars movie, American Beauty, Godfather, and Schindler's List. And the matrix factorization approach recommends Citizen Kane, A Rare Window, Singing in the Rain, North by Northwest, To Kill a Mockingbird. I don't know which movie this is. And maybe I should, I don't know, how are we doing with this? So here's the movie Airplane, again, lots of Star Wars. I don't know whether you know these movies. I don't know these movies, so I can't really judge. So maybe here this is another interesting example, Notting Hill. We have Forrest Gump, Princess Bride, another Star Wars, Shawshank Redemption, and Schindler's List, surprisingly. Whereas the matrix factorization approach seems to somewhat better capture the actual content of the movies by recommending Sleepless in Seattle, Pretty Woman, Emma, My Best Friend's Wedding, and You've Got Mail. I have some more, but I think in the interest of time, I skip this. So this is the summary of the talk. I described the topic modelings, how we as physicists can better understand topic modeling by thinking in terms of states and measurements. This helps me to think about topic models, which somewhat maybe seem more complicated than I think they are. I explained how we can, in principle, define association rules starting from a finite statistical mechanics model. I proposed a method for association rule mining starting from matrix factorization techniques. And what is crucial here is that we use a variational principle that where we optimize over state space. And in this sense, we use ideas from quantum foundations, or this is kind of, these ideas are closely related to ideas from quantum foundations where the state space, kind of generalized state spaces, really matter a lot. And therefore, I really regard quantum, some directions in quantum foundations as highly practical and applied. And I think it's fair to say that quantum foundations have the study of quantum foundations has the reputation of being very much not applied and disconnected from applications. But if you regard quantum foundations from this perspective, then maybe quantum foundations are among the most applied disciplines in physics. Because, for instance, they don't rely on the construction of a quantum computer. These things can, in some sense, be applied today. I think we should invest more into quantum foundations. And then I showed you some examples. Now, future directions, very little is known how to include dynamics. And I think as physicists, we are very much used to study dynamics. So I think as physicists, we have a lot to contribute to dynamics, the analysis of dynamics in data sets. And today's data sets are all about big data. So why not hope for some macroscopic effects in big data sets and approach them from a thermodynamics perspective? I think this would be really interesting. All right, so with this, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions?
So if you looked at the case where the association rules that you're trying to find are not absolute, where like the eta term isn't one, but you know some number close to one, like you usually would recommend this movie or buy this item instead of always?
Can you repeat the question?
So you had the condition that eta bread cheese equals one.
Yeah.
Have you looked at how well these approaches work if instead demand a number close to one to say that an item is usually bought, or sorry, buying an item usually implies buying a different item more?
So some of these things that I'm showing here are simplified. So we give some slack here. So we have an epsilon and ask for these numbers to be greater or equal to one minus epsilon. So there are some slacks hidden here.
Thank you. So just to clarify this question, association rules have something called confidence, which is defined for them. And the confidence can be 85%, 95%, or 100%, like the examples that you had. So if you go back to your table that you had, the original data set, the market basket data set that you had, you can see, for instance, that bread implies beer. That is an association rule with confidence 75%, right? Yeah. And a priori is designed to find association rules that exceed a certain threshold.
Yes.
Right? So does the matrix factorization approach, is it fine-tunable to the same effect? Can you ask for association rules that exceed 95%, because those are the interesting ones.
Remark. I think the term confidence is shouldn't make us too confident about if it's high, right? So it's like, because if you have like users that basically rate everything highly, then this may lead artificially to high confidence for a inferred association rule. So imagine that we had like 99 users, customers who just buy everything, then we get, or like just rate every movie highly, which is a selection bias because these are the active users, they contribute to the data. Then we get confidence rules, association rules with high confidence. But it's just because of a selection bias that we have in the data, because these were the active users and they just liked everything. So this, okay, this is like a side remark. Now in the matrix factorization definition, we have parameters that we can select, right? This is related to the previous question. So we can, when really running these algorithms, we have an epsilon here. So instead of forcing this inner product between to be equal to epsilon, we enforce it to be greater or equal to 1 minus epsilon, where epsilon defines, and then again, we also have an epsilon here. So this defines the strength, epsilon parameterizes the strength of the association rules. So if epsilon is close to 1, for instance, then we would only demand that this is like a little bit greater than 0, and this is a little bit greater than 0. So probabilistically speaking, it would only mean that users who are somewhat likely to like cheese are somewhat likely to like bread. Mm-hmm. So this epsilon parameterizes the strength of the association rule.
Okay. Thank you.
In the last slides, when you compare these two, I mean, there was very little overlap. Could you comment on that, or comment on your results, like afterwards, when you have the yes, I mean, all these results you presented now.
On these overlaps?
No, go further. Like the last slides where all the movies were listed, you know?
Oh.
Yes, exactly. So you're comparing two methods, but they hardly overlap. So is that good or is that bad? Or does it tell us anything? Like, why are they so different?
So ideally, I present these results and kind of claim that they're intuitively seem right, but of course you would like to have a better test by actually running such a platform and actually recommending these suggestions to user and then compare the methods in A-B testing. This I couldn't do. Now, is it good or bad that they overlap or don't overlap? Well, if you really have great confidence in the baseline, then you would like them to overlap. Right. Then it would be bad if they don't overlap. If you don't trust the baseline too much, if you think the baseline doesn't perform well, then you don't want them to overlap, because if you have overlap, then it just means that you reproduce bad results from the baseline, where the baseline is the a priori algorithm. So do I understand the question correctly, that you wonder whether it's good or bad that the recommendations are not identical? So it really depends on whether you want them to be identical or not. You want them to be identical if you think these are great suggestions, and you don't want the recommendations to be identical if you think these are more like average recommendations.
Yeah.
It's more quantum foundations than so. Of course, you can. I kind of skip this, but you can also use the variational definition in a quantum setting. Right? So you can instead of going to the generalized state and measurement spaces that occur in these matrix factorization models, you could postulate a quantum model, which I like to regard as a relaxation of classical models. And then you can just copy-paste the variational principle and optimize our quantum state space. And this is something that I've done, but I haven't shown you.
But I mean, was there already such a relaxation when you made this like outer approximation, or was that not related? Was that outer approximation already such a relaxation, like related to quantum mechanics, or was that not particularly related?
The matrix factorization approach, whether this is quantum or not?
Yes.
Is physical about this is this idea of quantizing ideas coming from the classical setting. And so we work in a classical setting. We come up with this idea to define association rules through supports of measurements, and then we quantize this idea. We take the variational principle and then basically copy paste it, or we get inspiration from the classical setting by defining association rules in the quantum setting, or in this generalized probabilistic setting. Matrix factorization setting. So this is, I think, I think physics is a great source for inspiration to come up with new ideas to interpret data. And this is just one approach. How do we model quantum experiments? From my naive perspective, we oftentimes model quantum experiments by proposing a classical model for what is happening in the experiment, and then we apply this rule of thumbs, we quantize the classical description. You can see this kind of as a quantization, right? We have this way to interpret data classically in terms of this variational principle that defines association rules, and then we quantize it. But quantization here really means just getting inspiration from the classical definition, because these definitions here, they make sense by themselves, because it means customers who are interested in cheese are also interested in bread. So these association rules, they are correct if the data is truly low rank. But we can do the same thing in the quantum setting. I think it makes a lot of sense to do this also in the quantum setting.
Hi. I think for the results, what at least I think some people want to know is why Star Wars was so prevalent. Is this a manifestation of some selection? Yeah, why is that a selection bias in the movie lens data set?
It has so many
connections, or?
All right, let me try to find, to really explain.
Because it seemed like the matrix factorization result didn't actually capture that selection bias, which seems like a good thing.
Yeah, well, the matrix factorization will also be subject to selection bias. We can talk about this offline, but hopefully less so. So these results suggest that it's less so the case. So, to answer this question, maybe it goes too much into detail, but this is the underlying principle under the a priori algorithm. So as was pointed out before, in the a priori this principle is the traditional approach is a combinatorial approach where we compute two numbers for each ansatz association rule. So let's say we want to consider the rule I implies J. Then we compute two numbers, support and confidence. Support is the frequency of transactions in the data set that show both cheese and bread. And confidence is the ratio between transactions that both show cheese and bread divided by the number of transactions that show cheese. And this was designed because this kind of should approximate the conditional probability for bread given cheese. Now, if we have very sparse data, and if it was true that the users contributing to this data set always a great many of them liked Star Wars movies. So many of the users contributing to this data set were users liking Star Wars movie, which is not representative, or is not completely representative for the complete population of Earth. So let's assume that this is the case. Then you get a data set which has high support and high confidence for liking Star Wars movie coming from whatever movie you start with. So maybe this is a bit too quick, but I hope this kind of answers you. So this is if you kind of write down an artificial data set where a great majority of the users like Star Wars movie and then some other movies, then this is what happens to be the case.
Hi, thanks. I was going to ask a similar question, but maybe I'll, given that the discussion over Star Wars and the fact that everybody loves Star Wars, I'll ask it a slightly different way. Have you considered or tried benchmarking using data that you generate, using rules that you create plus noise?
Generate data from these types of models?
Well, no, just make an inference, make a collection of inference models, and then generate data around it.
No, I didn't do that.
Is there a reason why that wouldn't be a straightforward thing to do?
So do I understand correctly? You wanna define a particular user and item vectors, and then you wanna sample data from the model that you generated.
Right, and then use both algorithms and benchmark the results because now you have truth.
Oh no! I'm sorry. Now I understand what you mean. So sorry. Yeah, this is what we tried with the synthetic data set. This was maybe not very clear. This is at the end. So some backup slides. I'm lost. This is what we tried here. So this is here we just define an artificial statistical mechanical model. We just initialize it on the computer, and then we sample from that model. And then we try to reproduce these diagrams. So this is here in this setting, we know ground truth. And I think if I understand you correctly, this is what you are referring to. So we create an artificial model, sample from it, and then try to reconstruct these diagrams. And this is what the baseline does. And this is what the matrix factorization approach does.
Right, I guess maybe I didn't recognize that because I didn't see like distilled numbers that have results that compare the two algorithms head to head in a quantitative sense.
So this is the complete model. So you mean like counting the correct links? I should have counted the correct edges. So here in the top case, at least in the limit where you can sample infinitely many times, so if you know the probabilities, and then you can then the rank of the data matrix equals the true rank, the true dimension of the underlying model, and then you reconstruct perfectly. So this is the perfect. So if you compare this top level of this figure, then this top level is identical to this figure here. So if you choose the correct dimension, then and in this asymptotic limit, there is we should add a bit more. We should play around more with noise, but in this asymptotic setting, you reconstruct correctly. Now let's assume we don't know the correct dimension, for whatever reason. Then you still see that if you go. So here, this is the 16-dimensional case. Now let's go to the 14-dimensional case. And let's see how we perform there. And this is how we perform in the 14-dimensional case. So looks still pretty good. And even this is a bit surprising to me, but even in the 12-dimensional case, where we lose four dimensions, we have that the lower lying structure of the correct diagram is still preserved, or some of the. Maybe I'm being too optimistic here, but. Some of the structure is still preserved, even if we lose four dimensions, even if we lose 25% of the dimensions of the true data.
Okay, and can you also comment on sort of the computational benchmarking between the two algorithms? The runtime or
the runtime. So one of the good. One way I think this algorithm is interesting in practice is because matrix factorization techniques, matrix factorization models, they're computed almost everywhere in this area. So this is something that people have. The people already have computed the vectors AU and BI. Now we provide a method to make further use of their computed vectors by inferring structural information about the data set, namely asymmetric interplay asymmetric relations between different items. So this is one thing. In practice, you almost always have already computed these vectors AU and BI. Now you leverage, you use these techniques to learn more about the data set. Now, what is the main bottleneck here? What do we actually need to do to compute these association rules? What we need to do is we need to perform a linear optimization, we need to minimize a linear function over some convex set. So it's a linear programming problem, because this is a polyhedra. And of course, the runtime of these linear optimization problems grow with the number of half-space constraints hidden in this outer approximation. So if the number of half space constraints grows very large, then the runtime of the linear program grows as well. However, if you fix, and this of course means that if you have great many items, then this becomes very slow, because with each item you get new or potentially new half space constraints. However, if you take the physics perspective, saying that the taste of people is a kind of a physical system, and this taste and the dimension of this physical system is independent of the measurements that you perform, which happens to be the case in physics, then you can just select some, or we hope that to be able to select some representative measurements, just randomly sample some representative measurements, and use those as a characterization of state space. So we don't use all available measurements in this hypothetical very big data regime, but we hope to just be able to select some subset and then use this subset of measurements as characterization of state space, of the outer approximation of state space. And therefore, the runtime, of course, it's independent of the number of transactions or the number of users, but if you use this kind of coarse-grained characterization of the outer approximation of state space, then the runtime also becomes independent of the number of items.
Thank you.
Quickly, before we go for coffee, what was the rule of thumb for choosing D? What's the rule of thumb for choosing D, the dimension? What was the rule of thumb for choosing the dimension D?
The basic approach to choosing D is a cross-validation, which means that you split your data set into a training set and a test set, and then you fit different dimensional models to the training set, and then you look how the models perform on the test set. So what is the error that you make on the test set? And then you choose the dimension that performs best on the test set. In practice, all of these dimensions are pretty low. And there is also a mathematical reason why these dimensions are all small. So you can actually just try. You can just brute force search the dimensions. And you have these patterns that this general overfitting patterns that if you start with small dimensions and you grow the dimension, then your test error decreases, but at some point you start to overfit, and then you choose, and then the test error grows, and then you choose the dimension that performs best on the test set.
You mentioned in one of your slides that there are some data sets for which traditional algorithms fail and physics-inspired work. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, I'm not sure if I have a backup slide for this. Oops, no. No, sorry, I forgot to prepare. Yeah, so I thought this would become too lengthy. So yeah, you can, let me try to, okay, I don't remember. So you can invent examples of data where the traditional method is doomed to fail. So these data sets are sparsely defined. So let's say we want to test a rule I implies J. And let's say, and the traditional methods with the support and confidence numbers and so on, they only focus on data corresponding to I and J when evaluating this method. So we may have a big data matrix, and then somewhere in this data matrix we have column I, and somewhere in the data matrix we have column J. And now I don't remember the details of this construction, but you can now fill in some of the entries here, some of the entries here, and maybe it makes intuitive sense to you that fitting these numbers with these probabilistic type models, you can find ambiguous rules. So you can find a model one where indeed I implies J, I implies J, but you can also find a model compatible with these numbers where I does not imply J. So this means that if the data was sampled from such a statistical mechanical model, then just looking at these numbers, we cannot decide what is true, because we have different models leading to contradicting conclusions. However, let's look at the matrix factorization approach, or really an actual statistical mechanical model, which can incorporate also additional entries out here. So let's say we know something about these entries also. Then we can use knowledge from these matrix factorization models are collaborative in the sense that they can use these numbers to say something about other numbers here. And in these counterexamples, you can show that using these numbers can actually help you decide between the two options. So basically, the matrix factorization models, as was realized or in this matrix completion settings and so on, they can work collaboratively by using entries that have a priori nothing to do with these columns, can be used to say something about these entries here. And therefore, we can distinguish these two rules. Traditional methods, they only focus on data here, but a matrix factorization technique can be used to say something about such a rule by incorporating these entries out here using the lower rank assumption. So it requires a lower rank assumption, but if you have a lower rank assumption, then you can use this data to say something about these columns that goes beyond what you can say just focusing on these columns by themselves.
I think we can stop here. So let's thank Cyril again for his talk.